Daniel chapter 8. This morning we come to, in our study, to this chapter, Daniel 8, and it's the second vision that was given to Daniel. Daniel 8:1 records the following. In the third year of the reign of Belshazzar, the king, a vision appeared to me, Daniel, subsequent to the one which appeared to me previously. A few weeks ago, we studied Daniel 7. That was his first vision, and that was given to him in the first year of the reign of Belshazzar. That would have been 553 B.C. So now it's 551 B.C. It's 2 years later. It is 12 years before Daniel 5. That's when the writing on the wall occurred, and Belshazzar was killed and Babylon taken over by the Medes and Persians. Now, Daniel's earlier vision was an overview of the time of the Gentiles, really stretching all the way from Babylon itself, the first kingdom, all the way to eternity. There was a special emphasis upon the fourth kingdom, the events that occurred there, the destruction of that kingdom, and then being turned over to the Ancient of Days, being ruled by the Son of God. This vision is similar in that it is a vision, but it's only of two kingdoms. And it's the two kingdoms that follow Babylon. This is going to be Medo-Persia and Greece. Now, there's quite a bit of detail given in this particular vision. In fact, liberal scholars reject Daniel as a prophecy because they cannot believe that it could be this detailed. They think it must be written after the fact. But we understand that fulfilled prophecy is one of the proofs of God's hand at work. That's why in Deuteronomy 18, you had to be 100% accurate. It's an important aspect of our own understanding and encouragement in following God. God not being a creature of time. Remember, God is not bounded by time. And I realize that's a very hard concept to grasp. There's nothing we can really think of that's not bound by time because we are creatures of time, but God's not bound by it. His relationship to it's not the same as ours. He is boundless. He's omnipotent, omniscient, eternal. Our God is great. That's what we've been singing about. The God of liberal theologians, their God can't predict the future because there is small God. He doesn't know what's going to happen. Our God is opposite of that. And so detailed prophecy is one of the things that is positive proof God's hand is at work. In the Old Testament, if a prophet proclaimed something, this is what's going to happen in the future, and it didn't happen, they were to be stoned. They were false prophets. I think if we did that in our own time, there'd be a lot of magazines that couldn't be published. There'd be no writers. Well, let's look at the vision. Daniel chapter 2, 8 verse 2. Now everything from 2 through 14 are things that Daniel sees in the vision. And the first part of the vision is he sees himself in another place. He says, "And I looked in the vision, and it came about while I was looking that I was in the citadel of Susa, which is in the province of Elam. And I looked in the vision, and I saw myself beside the Ulai Canal." Now we all know where that is, right? Of course not. So here's a map. All right, we'll have a lot of maps today so you can get some grasp of what's going on. So here's the Mediterranean Sea, Jerusalem, the Babylonian Empire. Here's Babylon. Here's Susa. This is the province of Elam. Okay, that gives you an idea of what's there. This is an important city. In fact, this is the city where Nehemiah serves Artaxerxes as his wine steward. This is the city where all the events of Esther take place. It becomes the capital of the Medo-Persian Empire. That's about 230 miles west or east of Babylon, to give you some kind of scale, 120 miles north of the Persian Gulf. So it wasn't an easy distance, especially when you had to walk it. But that gives you some idea. Now this Ulai, now it's a canal. There are two main rivers by Susa, and you can see them coming down there. One is, at that time, was called the Choapsis, and the other was the Caprotis rivers. And between the two canal or rivers, they dug a canal. It was about 900 feet wide, and the fortress was built on one side of it. It had this canal. Daniel sees himself in his vision in the city of Susa by this canal, by this fortress. This is all happening within his vision. Now, starting in verse 3, Daniel relates what he sees as he lifts his eyes and he sees a bunch of things going on. So look there at verse 3. Now we're going to read through the whole section. They're going to go back and interpret it when Gabriel comes on the scene and starts giving interpretation. So starting in verse 3. Then I lifted my gaze and looked, and behold, a ram which had two horns was standing in front of the canal. Now the two horns were long, but one was longer than the other, with the longer one coming up last. I saw the ram butting westward, northward, and southward, and no other beast could stand before him, nor was there anyone to rescue from his power, but he did as he pleased and magnified himself. While I was observing, behold, a male goat was coming from the west over the surface of the whole earth without touching the ground. And the goat had a conspicuous horn between his eyes. And he came up to the ram that had two horns, which I had seen standing in front of the canal, and rushed at him in his mighty wrath. And I saw him come beside the ram, and he was enraged at him, and he struck the ram and shattered his two horns, and the ram had no strength to withstand him. So he hurled him to the ground and trampled on him, and there was none to rescue the ram from his power. Then the male goat magnified himself exceedingly, but as soon as he was mighty, the large horn was broken, and in its place there came up four conspicuous horns toward the four winds of the heaven. And out of them came forth a rather small horn, which grew exceedingly great toward the south, toward the east, toward the beautiful land. And it grew up to the host of heaven and caused some of the hosts and some of the stars to fall to the earth, and it trampled them down. It even magnifies itself to be equal with the commander of the host, and it removed the regular sacrifice from him, and the place of his sanctuary was thrown down. And on account of transgression, the host will be given over to the horn along with the regular sacrifice, and it will fling truth to the ground and perform its will and prosper. Then I heard a holy one speaking, and another holy one said to that particular one who was speaking, "How long will the vision about the regular sacrifice apply while the transgression causes horror so as to allow both the holy place and the host to be trampled?" And he said to me, "For 2,300 evenings and mornings, then the holy place will be properly restored." Quite a few years ago, I was asked to lead a Bible study discussion for another Bible teacher who had to be away. And they happened to be studying this chapter, Daniel chapter 8. And as we started the study, they read through these verses, just as we just read through them. And then they began to discuss among themselves what they could be mean. Who's the ram? Who's the goat? What could they possibly reference to? And their speculations got kind of interesting, but they had nothing to do with the text of the scriptures. It wasn't related. So I let that go on for a while, and then I finally asked, did any of you read through the whole chapter? None of them had. In fact, they told me they were told not to read through the whole chapter, that they had to figure this out without reading the whole chapter. And I looked and like, we're going to learn a little bit about how to study the Bible. So we read through the rest of the chapter and we started pointing out context. We always look at context. And in this particular chapter, there's a lot of people who will look at this first section here, and they can wax eloquent about what it possibly means and never bother to find out that at the end of the chapter, God sends Gabriel, an angel, who interprets it all for him. It's not that difficult. But I mention that because even in commentaries, we generally find, because commentaries are generally verse by verse, that they always try to do something with these before they'll get to what the angel said about it. Now, in conservative commentaries, that means they end up always going through it twice. Because they did read to the end of the chapter, and they know it has to do with what Gabriel said, so they keep working that in. They simply assume it, and they keep referencing it. So the first part, they try and explain all the phrasing and referring to the end of the chapter, which you haven't got to yet. And then when they get to the end of the chapter, they go through it all again. I guess that makes for a thicker commentary, and maybe you pay more for it. I don't know. But that's still not the way we do it. We should look at context. So now we understand the vision. We're going to start looking at what he said. Liberal commentators are not bound to context, so their commentaries are really interesting of how wild they can get in speculation, which you get to the end of the chapter and find out it has nothing to do with what they just talked about. Remember, the Bible is the best interpreter of the Bible. We always go to that. Context. Context is king. You have the context of the chapter, which in this case includes what will be at the end of it in Gabriel's interpretation of this vision. You have the context of the book, which in this case will include all the other visions that refer to these two kingdoms he's going to be talking about here. They give you additional insights into what's going on and what they're about. That's context. Then you have the context of which testament, Old Testament, whose it's written to, the context of the Bible. You don't have to go to mythologies of other cultures to try and figure this out. It's not difficult. We go to the scriptures in context. Okay, that's an important lesson for us anytime. The proper biblical method for all Bible study is put in its context, and that's the way we'll understand this vision given here to Daniel. Now, this next section of the chapter, verses 15 through 19, we find that Daniel wants to understand the meaning of what's in his vision, and we do as well. And he didn't resort to speculations about it, neither should we. God intervenes, explains to Daniel, and that intervention is going to be our source as well. Look at verse 15. And it came about when I, Daniel, had seen the vision that I sought to understand it, and behold, standing before me was one who looked like a man. And I heard the voice of a man between the banks of the Ulai, and he called out and said, Gabriel, give this man an understanding of the vision. So he came near to where I was standing, and when he had came, I was frightened and fell on my face. But he said to me, Son of man, understand that the vision pertains to the time of the end. Now while he was talking with me, I sank into a deep sleep with my face to the ground, but he touched me and made me stand upright. And he said, Behold, I am going to let you know what will occur at the final period of the indignation, for it pertains to the appointed time of the end. So starting with verse 15, the vision takes a turn. Now, it's still in the vision, understand that. But now in the vision, Daniel's not seeing the activities of the ram and the goat. He sees himself back by the Ulai Canal near the citadel of Susa. And he wants to understand this vision, and God sends him someone that looks like a man, later identified as Gabriel, to explain this. Now, the voice that identifies it just comes, it says, from between the banks of the Ulai. There is no indication of anybody being seen. It's just a voice out there. There's no indication in the text of where the voice originated from. It's just there it was, telling Gabriel, go explain this to Daniel. Because the text does not identify who spoke, it's only speculation about who did it, God or an angel. We don't know. But it directs Gabriel, by name, explain this to Daniel. Give him an understanding of the vision you've seen. Now, we do know the identity of Gabriel. Why? Other scripture passages speak about him. The name Gabriel itself can mean either man of God or warrior of God. Warrior of God probably is a little better translation of his name. And Gabriel is going to appear to Daniel again in chapter 9, verse 21, when he is sent by God again to answer the prayer that Daniel gives in the beginning of the chapter. So Gabriel shows up twice here in Daniel. Then in Luke 1, he shows up to Mary. And he is the angel that announces to Mary that she is the one who's going to bear the Messiah. And in Luke 1:19, he states this about himself, I am Gabriel, who stands in the presence of God, and I have been sent to speak to you and bring you this good news. That is why we know this is an angel. We know he's not just a man, he is an angel. But characteristically, as we go through the scriptures, we will find that angels will manifest themselves to humans as men. That's their normal mode of operation. That's how they manifest themselves. So Gabriel then comes to Daniel, and Daniel falls on his face. All right? Gabriel begins to speak to Daniel, and he completely loses it, and he says he sank into a deep sleep. Remember, he already had said he was frightened. Daniel passes out. And I think you and I would probably do the same thing. The normal reaction we find to humans encountering supernatural beings is fear. Go through the scriptures and you'll find the first statement usually made by an angel to any human they're talking to is something to the effect of, don't be frightened. Why do they have to say that? Because you are frightened. You should be frightened. Something different is there that's way beyond you. Now, we find that as the effect that angels have had not only on Daniel, but John's revelation, Mary's response, just consistently you find this is the response. And yet today, we have people who make claims that, well, they talk with angels. They get visited by angels or had been visited. And then you ask further questions, you find their reaction wasn't like this. And so I have to admit, here I become skeptical. I wonder what you actually did talk to. Doesn't sound like an angel to me. You weren't even frightened? Seems like you should be. So that's the first thing that makes me a skeptic. But then anybody who makes such claims, you then have to always examine that claim. How does it match with Scripture? Remember what Paul said back in Galatians? Galatians is all about a defense of the gospel and not having it perverted. He said, even if an angel comes to you and preaches a different gospel, let them be accursed. Anathema. That's strong language. He says it twice within just two or three verses. That's strong. John warned that the spirits were to be tested because there were many spirits going out, and they're liars and they're deceivers, and they're certainly around us. You turn on quote-unquote Christian TV, and you will find heretics. You will find deceivers. You will hear them on quote-unquote Christian radio. You will find their books in Christian bookstores. They are around. How do you know what is true and what is not? You go to the Bible. Go back and check out what they say. Does it match what Scripture says? That's key. So Daniel is flat on his face. He's passed out. And Gabriel then reaches down and touches Daniel and causes him to stand up. Gabriel then explained the vision that concerned what's going to occur at the final period of the indignation. He says, for it pertains the appointed time of the end. Now, the first period of the indignation probably refers to the Assyrian and Babylonian captivities. We find that Isaiah 10, verse 5 and 25 uses the same terminology to describe God's use of Assyria upon Israel. And then in Jeremiah, he also uses the same kind of language in describing what God is going to be doing to Judah. So that'd be the first part of the indignation. They are conquered and they are carried away, Judah being carried away by Babylon starting in 605 BC. The latter indignation would then refer to the period that follows this period. Things changed in 538 BC. To this point, they've been deported. In 538, King Cyrus issues a decree that allows the Jews to go back to the land to rebuild the temple. It's a different period from the first. One, they're deported. Now they can come back to the land, but is God's favor now upon them? No, they are still under the time of the Gentiles. And the Gentiles still rule over them. They may be in Jerusalem, but they're not autonomous. It's Gentile kings that are over them. This is the latter part of the period. And that will continue within this context until the latter time, which would then be from 538 until Messiah's return. Until that point in time, the Jewish nation is dominated by Gentiles. Even today, even though the nation of Israel is back in the land, can it freely do whatever it wants? No, it can't. It is dominated by Gentile powers. And that's why the United States and the European nations are always mixed in. They're trying to figure out something to put pressure on them, to do this, to do that, do something else. Because if it wasn't for military equipment being sent to them and military aid and finances to buy the stuff, what would happen to that nation? It's surrounded by enemies. And in our own time, we're seeing that the enemies are rising again. Egypt has changed. The quote-unquote, what do they call it, Arab Spring? It's more like a tsunami. And it has to do with Islam. And Egypt is not favorable to Israel anymore. Their ambassador had to flee because people broke in and destroyed their embassy, fortunately, while he happened to be away to begin with. It's changed. It's going to go back to what Israel experienced at the beginning. Egypt will become another nation, one more enemy surrounding it. Israel cannot do what it would like to do. It cannot rebuild the temple, can it? Because they know that would start a holy war. They're dominated. So this latter period of indignation really is referring to from 538 BC, they can go back to the land. They're not in deportation. There was freedom to go back, but they're still under Gentile dominance. And that will continue until Messiah returns. So that's what this is referring to. Now, Gabriel then proceeds to explain this vision. So we'll look at what Gabriel says and then also work back to what he had said earlier. So the first is the ram. That's mentioned in verses 3 and 4 and verse 20. In verse 20, Gabriel says, "The ram which you saw with the two horns represents the kings of Media and Persia. The ram corresponds with the silver chest and the arms of Nebuchadnezzar's dream and the bear of Daniel's earlier vision." Now remember, the angel is telling Daniel this before Medo-Persia arises as the world-dominant power. It's rising, but it isn't there yet. But he says, this is the one. Remember also, the perspective always is what dominates the land of Israel. That is key. Not who has the largest territory. What nation will dominate Israel? Now, the description of the empire ruled by the kings of Media and Persia as a ram is very appropriate. C.F. Kyle remarks in his commentary that in the Buddhahesh, the guardian spirit of the Persian kingdom appears under the form of a ram. He then continues, quote, "The Persian king, when he stood at the head of his army, bore instead of a diadem the head of a ram." John Walvoord adds in his commentary that the different lands were assigned to the signs of the zodiac, with Persia being assigned Aries, which is the ram. In Daniel's vision, the ram has two horns. Gabriel says these are two kingdoms, or represent really two kings of Media and Persia. They had combined together, unified themselves, so it was a conglomerate empire. Each horn would have represented one of those kings, but both nations were joined together in one cooperative empire. So two horns on one animal. One empire, but two kings. The Medo-Persian Empire was dominated by the Medes until 550 BC when Cyrus, a Persian, became king. And from that point on, the Persians dominated the empire. Now remember, they said that there's two horns. One grew larger, and that one came up last. That's exactly what happened in Medo-Persia. The Persians were this small area in here. Media was already this area. They joined together, and this is just before Cyrus. This is the size of the Medo-Persian Empire. It was already very large. Here's the Babylonian Empire. But remember, Scripture is always what controls Jerusalem. That's key. So it was already large. Now, in Daniel's vision, the ram butts westward, northward, and southward, and says nothing could stand before the ram or rescue from its power. Another fitting description of exactly what happens. So this is prior to Cyrus. It's already a large kingdom, very large territories to the east. Remember, Susa is right here. And where Daniel is seeing is the ram goes forth from where? From Susa and goes direction. So it's going to be always from here and which direction. So first of all, we find that Cyrus conquers Babylon in 539 BC. That is to the west. He then goes on. He inherits the Babylonian Empire, takes out Syria, moves down through Damascus, and takes over Jerusalem. That's where he goes first. That's westward. Cyrus then next, in 521, goes north. And again, from Susa, he goes up into the lands of the Armenians and then into the Scythians, and he conquers those areas. or at least makes a lot of headway in them. He doesn't conquer them completely, but he certainly takes over a large, vast area of their territory. While in battling the Scythians, Cyrus dies in battle, 529 BC, and Cambyses takes over from him. That's his son. He finishes the work up north, and then guess where he goes? South. He goes down into Egypt and conquers Egypt. So that's southward. That's in 525 BC. So now this is the extent of the Medo-Persian Empire. It's a vast area extending from the Arabian Sea north to the Aral Sea. So that's from here all the way up to the Aral Sea, this whole section here. Then west all the way through Asia Minor. And they had some success going into Thrace and Macedonia and even a little bit into Greece. But we're going to find later they keep getting stopped there. All the way through the Palestine, down into Egypt, and they were even going westward, but they got stopped there too. In fact, the plan was for them to go all the way to Carthage, but the army that was being sent disappeared. Disappeared out in the desert. The only thing they can think of is that it got caught in sandstorms and was buried. Because it simply disappeared. It was no more. It had never been found. And then, of course, we're probably a little more familiar with Greek history, that, or at least it used to be taught in school. Usually you learn something about Greek history. And you hear about things like the Battle of Marathon. Anybody know what a marathon is today? Yeah, okay, why is it 26 miles? It's from running from the Battle of Marathon back to Athens to declare, "Is we won," and then the guy, what happened to him? He dropped dead. He got the news out and died. Just for that reason, I don't think I ever want to run a marathon. I let other people do that. I'm not doing that. I get to the end and said, "I finished." And probably would have said, he should have said, "He is finished." He's done. But Marathon was 590 BC, and they lost. Xerxes finally won at Thermopylae. Darius' father had lost at Marathon. He wins the battle there. He goes in. Athens is unprotected. He burns it, but he has a problem. He has to be supplied by his navy. So while he's over there, the Greek navy traps his navy at a place called Salamis. And between a terrible storm and the Greek navy completely decimates, well, can't decimate means 10%, so it can't be decimated. So complete wiped out. How's that? Decimated isn't a strong enough word. Wiped it out. Now you have no navy. You're in a foreign land. How do you supply your troops? You're in trouble. So he retreated, and in the process of retreating, he ends up losing as well Thrace and the north side of the Hellespont. That's this area where you can cross over into Europe from Asia Minor. He loses that. After that period, Medo-Persia never was a threat to Greece again. A century and a half later, the Persian Empire would collapse very quickly before Greece, and that becomes the next dominant empire. Verse 21. "And the shaggy goat represents the kingdom of Greece, and the large horn that is between his eyes is the first king." Now again, this is hundreds of years before this happens. Greece was not a major dominant world power. It was a powerful place, but they were kept battling themselves in this period of time when Daniel's making the prophecy. But the angel, Gabriel, says is that nation is going to become dominant. And this first king is going to be incredible. Now, in the vision that Daniel saw, going back to the verses 5 through 14, this goat comes from the west. It goes east very quickly. How quickly? It says its feet they don't even touch the ground. It's zipping so fast. That's fast. It's extremely fast. The goat has this conspicuous horn between its eyes that signifies a singular strength and intelligence. The goat then shatters the ram. It tramples him. The goat then magnifies himself, and at the height of his power, this horn is broken off, and four conspicuous horns grow out in its place toward the four winds of heaven. Who was that? Well, that's Alexander the Great, right? And it's the advance of his empire was incredible. If you remember some of your history from then, Alexander's father, Philip, had already consolidated Macedonia, Greece, and Thrace. And then in 336 BC, Philip was murdered. And Alexander becomes king. He is only 20 years old. Just 20. Now, it takes him a couple months to put down the revolts that have arisen because there's always a power struggle. He does that. And then he starts planning out what his father wanted to do, which was go and attack Persia. Sort of retribution. For hundreds of years, they had threatened Greece. Now they're going to go the other direction. And he begins in 334 BC with the invasion of Asia Minor and a victory at a place called Granicus. That's up here in the top, right here. He crosses the Hellespont, comes there, and he has his first victory. 334 BC. Remember, he's only been king 2 years. 2 years a king, he's 22 years old, and he's taking on Persia, the dominant empire of the time. The very next year, and he conquers this whole area through Asia Minor, comes up and down, and then here at Issus, he has another victory over the Persians. That's 333 BC. So in 1 year, he now has all of Asia Minor. 332 BC, he attacks and conquers Tyre. Tyre had never been conquered before. It's an interesting story in itself, but he takes it out too. He then proceeds down south. Eventually, Egypt actually opens its doors to him, and he establishes Alexander in 331 BC. One thing that's interesting, when he goes through Jerusalem, they also open the doors to him. And the priest basically said, we knew you were coming. How'd they know he was coming? They had the book of Daniel. They could see, this is this guy. Just from what already had happened, this is this guy. So they weren't fearful of him. They knew where he was going to go next. He wasn't going to hang around. He had other places to conquer. He then goes back north to Syria, and then he turns east into the heart of the Persian Empire. And then in 331, now remember, he establishes Alexandria. So in the same year, he also makes it all the way back up, and here in a place called Gaugamela, he has the final defeat of the Persian Empire. He shatters its army. It's a very interesting battle to read about to begin with. Completely shatters it. The king flees, tries to hide in other areas of Media, but is eventually murdered himself. There really is no Persian army left. It's minor resistance. He continues on. The next year, he has traveled all the way down to Persepolis, 330 BC. He captures all these cities. This one he burns, destroys it. So he's come all the way down here, out the heart of the Babylonian Empire. Now he goes back up to Media. Ends up 329. The next year, he's come all the way through this section, crosses the Hindu Kush, and goes into Bactria and takes all this area. Now, this area is not as easy. It takes him a couple years to subdue it. Then in 327, he is crossed in the Indus River, and he's in India. And he would have kept going, except in 326 BC at Hyphasis, his army says, no more. We're not going any farther. They refuse. We want to go home. All we've been doing is warring for all these years. Haven't we conquered kind of enough land? Right? I kind of like to see my family again. I got a sweetheart waiting. I'd like to go to her. They say, we're not going any farther. And actually, he yields. But he's in a bad spot. Where does he go? Well, he starts south. So they start south along the Indus River. And coming south, this is a hard area to get through. He does have some battles with different kings. 2 years it takes him to get down to the Indian Ocean. He gets there, and they build ships, and they finally head back west. Now consider that. In 10 years, he has conquered all of what had been the Persian Empire. plus into India, plus he had Greece, Macedonia, and Thrace in 10 years. That is an incredible amount of territory taken, even by modern standards. And he didn't have tanks. He didn't have wheeled vehicles. He had horses and chariots and a lot of men walking. Would you have been part of this army walking all that way? I'm sorry, there's no lifts, there's no trucks. You get to walk the whole thing. That's incredible. So no wonder Scripture describes this as this goat coming across swiftly without its feet even touching the ground. Well, he continues his explanation. Verse 22, just to finish Alexander, we should finish this up. Remember, his horn was broken at the height of his power. He's 33 years old. He gets back to Babylon, and they're still not quite sure what killed him, but he ended up with a terrible fever, and he died June 11, 323 BC. At the height of his power, the horn is broken, just as Gabriel had said it was going to happen. Verse 22, and the broken horn and the four horns that arose in its place represent four kingdoms which will arise from his nation, although not with his power. So four nations are going to arise out of this, but they're not going to nearly be as strong as Alexander. So with Alexander's sudden death, there's a power struggle. What's going to happen? If you know your history, there was actually five generals who were vying for territory. This says four. What happened? Well, Cassander, he took the area of west. Remember, it said to the four winds. The west, that became Cassander's area, Macedonian Greece. Lysimachus took the north area, that's Thrace, Western Asia Minor as well. There's a fellow named Antigonus. He wanted the rest of the Asia Minor. He lost to Seleucus. He was no more. There ended up being four kingdoms. Antigonus was very short-lived. Ptolemy took Egypt and the area of the beautiful land, Palestine we call it now, and then Seleucus got the major part of it. He's probably the more devious of the generals. Seleucus actually traded off territory. This area here that Alexander conquered, he traded that for elephants. Now you say, why would you want elephants? Because they were really good at war. And that meant he became dominant. He was able to fight off the other kings. So now you have this huge power struggle. Four kingdoms out of the one. And they're all characterized by Grecian thought. The centuries that would follow are filled with war, intrigue, as the resulting kingdoms are struggling for power against each other. That's especially true between Seleucus's descendants and Ptolemy's descendants. Gabriel continues his explanation. Look at verse 23. And in the latter period of the rule, when the transgressors have run their course, a king will arise insolent and skilled in intrigue, and his power will be mighty, but not his own power. He will destroy to an extraordinary degree and prosper and perform his will. He will destroy mighty men and the holy people, and through his shrewdness, he will cause deceit to succeed by his influence. He will magnify himself in his heart. He will destroy many while they are at ease. He will even oppose the prince of princes, but he will be broken without human agency. And the vision of his evenings and mornings, and the vision of the evenings and mornings, which has been told is true, but keep the vision secret, for it pertains to many days in the future. Now that's part of Gabriel's interpretation. It concerns this small horn, the small horn that grew out of one of the horns and became large and dominant. This is not the little horn seen in Daniel's earlier vision of the four beasts. Remember, in chapter 7, that horn arises out of the fourth empire. This one arises out of the third. That one arises out as a separate horn, an 11th horn out of 10 horns, and supplants three horns. This is a horn that arises out of one of the four horns. It doesn't supplant the other ones, it's simply one that arises out of it and becomes dominant. The horn in chapter 7 would persecute God's people for 42 months. That's 3.5 years. This small horn arising out of the Grecian Empire rises from one of the four horns and it persecutes God's people for 2,300 days. And I know your math is wonderful, so you know that's 6.3 years. Okay? This small horn is a fellow named Antiochus IV, surnamed Epiphanes. He reigned from 175 to 164 BC. He was the youngest son of Antiochus III. His brother Seleucus Philopater had taken the throne when his father had died. But somebody murdered Seleucus, and Antiochus ends up with the throne. He is not the rightful heir. Seleucus has a son. This is an extremely evil man. Now, the Seleucids, who controlled Syria and the Ptolemies, which controlled Egypt, were in constant conflict. We saw that in the earlier map. Guess what's in the middle? Israel. And so Israel was often the victim of these two warring nations. Antiochus, we are told, or this horn, is going to invade to the south and to the east and toward the beautiful land. Antiochus invades Egypt to the south, Babylon to the east, and he took over Israel and Jerusalem, which is the beautiful land. That's verses 10 and 24. The books of Maccabees records many of Antiochus' atrocities after he'd conquered Israel. He promoted Greek culture and Greek gods, especially Zeus, also known as Jupiter. Many of the Jews fell to this. They rejected the Mosaic law. Many of them followed Greek licentiousness. They built gymnasiums. They worshiped the Greek gods. Hence the stars that fell, the people of God that fell into this. These are the transgressors. Let me go back up one. These are the transgressors. And they, plus Antiochus, persecuted those who were still faithful in Israel. The persecution ranged from mocking to murder and everything in between. 1 Maccabees 1:29 through 31 records a plundering destruction of Jerusalem, while 1 Maccabees 1:24, 27, 57 through 64, and 2 Maccabees 5:11 through 14 and 23 through 26 records several of times, not just once, but several of times that he slaughtered Jews. That was his nature. That's how evil this guy was. Now, 1 and 2 Maccabees are not in Scripture, but they are important books. They are a history, skewed, but it is a history of this period of time, recording what this guy was doing. Now, Gabriel also said that this horn would be insolent and skilled in intrigue, verse 23, and that through his shrewdness he would use deceit to succeed by his influence. And Antiochus was very well known for this. Began with his behavior concerning his nephew Demetrius. He was the rightful heir with the help of a fellow named Eumenes, the second Soter of Pergamon. Aren't you glad you don't have that name? He probably thought it was normal. Well, he enabled him to become king, and then Antiochus had his nephew murdered. You don't want anybody at a challenge of the throne. In 173 BC, he conspired with a group of Jews to have the godly priest named Ananias replaced by his Hellenized brother named Jason. Ananias was then murdered. Then in 171 BC, just 2 years later, Antiochus replaced Jason with a fellow who was called Menelaus. Why? Because Menelaus offered greater tribute. This is a man, he doesn't really care. He just wants it for himself. He was also known to disguise himself and go in among the people to find out what his subjects were thinking. You better be thinking the right thing. He had set up a situation in which people would think they were safe and at ease, and then he would attack. He did this, 1 Maccabees 1:29 through 33 records. His tax collector, a fellow named Apollonius, he entered Jerusalem in peace. As soon as the people let down their guard, he attacked. He plundered the city, he slaughtered the Jews, and he sold off the women and children to slavery. This was a man that would magnify himself and blaspheme God and stop the sacrifice, it says in 11 through 14. What did Antiochus do? In 170, Antiochus plundered the temple. 2 years later, he started executing a policy of extermination of Judaism, and Jerusalem was plundered, as already mentioned above. Antiochus forbid the observance of the Sabbath. You may not observe the festivals. If you circumcise your son, the mother was killed, murdered. All the sacred books had to be surrendered. If you were found with one, you were executed. The regular sacrifices were stopped. It wasn't until Kislev 25, 168 BC, or on Kislev 25, 168 BC, a statue, and there's some question about exactly what the statue was. It was either Zeus, but it might possibly have been a statue of Antiochus himself. It was placed in the temple above the altar, and then the Jews were compelled to offer sacrifices of it, to it, of pigs. They were also compelled to offer sacrifices to other Greek idols that had been set up throughout the land. Daniel 8:14 states there would be 2,300 mornings and evenings before the holy place would be properly restored. That would not occur until the Maccabean revolt and the cleansing of the temple that occurred there. That event is a reason for the celebration of Hanukkah. The Maccabees revolted, they took over the temple, and they didn't have enough sacred oil. And they only had oil for one day, it lasted eight. That's why it's the Festival of Lights. It's all about cleansing the temple. That occurred December 25th, 165 BC. So the beginning point, 2,300 days earlier, would have been in 171 BC, and that correlates exactly with the start of Antiochus' severe persecution of the Jews with the murder of Ananias. That's the kind of character this was. Hundreds of years before, Gabriel tells Daniel, there's a guy who's coming, and this is what he's going to do. Now, one final aspect of the prophecy about the small horn is that he'd be broken without human agency. And there are a lot of different accounts of Antiochus' death. It ranges from he died of grief because he lost his lands. Another one says he died of epilepsy. And some others said he died of either madness or disease. But none of those are by human hands. Antiochus IV gave himself the title Antiochus Theos Epiphanes. It means Antiochus the visible God. He actually thought of himself as the manifestation of Zeus, also known as Jupiter. The people had another name for him. It was a wordplay. They called him Antiochus Epiphanes. Sounds almost the same, Epiphanes. And it means Antiochus the madman. Well, in many ways the same. This man proved himself to be evil, and he shows all the evidence of being empowered and controlled by Satan, because of this persecution of God's chosen people, the Jews. All this prophesied hundreds of years beforehand. Now, Gabriel concludes in the NAS, this is not a good translation here in that version, to keep the vision secret. The King James, New King James do better. They say it, shut it up or seal it up. The idea here is not to hide it. You don't give a revelation to then hide it. The idea here is to preserve it, which means you'd have to write it down so it's going to be available for future generations, and that's what Daniel did. He wrote it down. That's why it's available to us. He preserved it. He shut it up. He secured it. Now, Daniel's own response to all this is recorded in verse 27. Then I, Daniel, was exhausted and sick for days, and I got up again and carried on the king's business, but I was astounded at the vision, and there was none to explain it. The vision, the interpretation, it completely overwhelms Daniel. He becomes sick. It's days before he can even get up and start carrying out his normal responsibilities. And yet, even with that, he is perplexed by it. Gabriel had interpreted, but there was still so much he did not understand. What is this about? As I said in my previous sermon on chapter 7, though we so often think we'd like to know the future, if we knew what the future held, it would probably frighten us. We probably wouldn't like it. Our hope and our trust cannot be in knowing details about the future. That's not where hope comes from. Confident assurance for the future has to rest in the one who holds it into his hands. And who is that? That's the Lord God, our Creator, right? We also have that trust because we know that God will carry out his promises even as these fulfilled prophecies prove. If he's made a promise, he's going to keep it. And we're assured of that. And I realize that a basically a history lesson like today, for those who don't like history, it's like, oh, get over it, Pastor. Move on. For those who like history, like me, I actually could have gone a lot longer. But why look at these things? Why know history? As someone as well said, history is his story. And when we look at prophecies and we see this kind of detail and it's carried out and fulfilled, we should have a greater confidence in God. If this is what he has done in the past, can we not trust him for what he said is still future? He fulfills all of his promises. That includes all those given to us as his followers. We know his love for us. It was proven for us, wasn't it? Can there be any question of it? God demonstrated his love toward us, and while we were yet sinners, Christ died for us. There's nothing more he could do to prove his love for you. It is proven. And we know that perfect love casts out all fear, 1 John 4:18. We also know that he will never forsake us. He will never leave us. That's Jesus' promise at the end of the Great Commission, isn't it? Lo, I am with you always, even to the end of the age. And so though we do not know what is going to be occurring in our lives from now until whenever he returns or we pass from this life, he's with us. And that should be enough. That should be the comfort. And one day his promise is that we get to be in heaven with him. Isn't that the promise of John 14:1-3? He has gone to prepare a place for us, and he will return to receive us to himself. Do I really need to know all the details between? It's enough to know where the end is. I'll let him take care of the details. He says he knows what he's doing. He loves me. I can be content. And so until then, we have a simple quest to walk with the Lord faithfully, to serve him however he has gifted you, however he directs you, for the purpose of his glory. Life is not about you. It is not about me. It is about the God that we serve, the God that created us. The quest of our lives is to bring him glory. Daniel did so. We need to do the same.